Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Stephen Hawley Martin about his book, Afterlife, The Whole Truth, Second Edition. Powerful evidence you will never die. Stephen has had half dozen titles achieve bestseller status on Amazon and is the only three-time winner of the Writer's Digest Book Award. In all, he has written 17 books under his own name and has ghostwritten half dozen more. For 2 years, he hosted a successful weekly internet talk show, The Truth About Life, which averaged 30,000 listener downloads every episode. Hi, Stephen. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Hey, Simon. I'm glad to be here. Good to be with you again.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Afterlife, The Whole Truth, Second Edition. Powerful Evidence You Will Never Die. What's the difference between the first edition and the second edition?
Well, the first edition has been a very good seller and still is probably my best seller, but I decided that there was something missing from it, and that is the science behind the fact that we are spiritual beings, non-material beings, that the universe itself is non-material, that it seems to be solid stuff, and for certainly many generations, we've learned in school that all that exists is material substance, and that the fact that we have consciousness came about because of evolution, Darwin's survival of the fittest, and that eventually that produced a brain, and that the brain produced consciousness. And that's why a lot of people think that there's no life after death, because when the body dies and the brain dies, then there would be no more consciousness if that's true. But the fact of the matter is that that quantum physicists figured out a long time ago. In fact, Max Planck, the German scientist who came up with quantum theory, said in 1931 that consciousness, basically he said consciousness is the ground of being, that we can't get beyond consciousness when we're studying reality, that and so that really everything is, in fact, well, Einstein said E equals mc squared, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, and that says, as well as what Max Planck says, there is no such thing as matter per se, that it's all energy. And you put Max Planck's quote with that, and it's conscious energy. And so what I decided to do, since I had this book that was doing very well about the afterlife, based mainly on research that's been done at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, I thought what was missing was that information from quantum mechanics, quantum physicists, that demonstrates why it's true that we are eternal spiritual beings, that they're, the whole idea that nothing exists except material substance is incorrect. And so they're teaching the incorrect stuff in school. And so I added basically a first chapter to the book that explains all that and explains the science, the quantum mechanics experiments that have been done, that demonstrate it, and so forth. So that's really basically what the second edition is. It's the first edition plus the science that backs up the fact that there is an afterlife, that we are eternal beings. So there you go.
Well, there's all sorts of lines of evidence that you've got in the book, and I wanted to go over some of them.
Right.
One of them I find fascinating is what you call deathbed recovery of lost consciousness.
That's true. That is a phenomenon that is documented in historical writings by doctors and so forth going back hundreds of years. And in fact, my own grandmother, who when she died, she had been in a coma and had suffered from dementia for quite some time. And right before she died, about, 20 minutes or so before she died, she sort of came out of it, had a conversation with her family, knew she was dying, talked about it, and then passed away. And apparently that's a fairly common occurrence that hospice nurses witness all the time. And basically what that particular information that's in the book came from the University of Virginia School of Medicine. I mentioned them earlier. They have a department, a division really called the Division of Perceptual Studies, that's studying consciousness, and they study near-death experiences, children's memories of past lives, people who have brain damage but still are just normal, have normal consciousness, and this phenomenon of terminal lucidity, which apparently happens all the time. And they theorize that the reason it happens is as the person is dying, the brain, which is a receiver of consciousness and integrates consciousness with the body, lets go of or releases the individual's consciousness. And actually, it was the brain that was keeping them, because of the damage or whatever that's gone on in the brain, keeping them from being lucid, causing their dementia and so forth. Whereas they, as a conscious being, are still very, very much conscious. And so as the brain releases it at the end of their life, many people, some percentage of those who are dying, become lucid right before they die. And that's how that phenomenon takes place. So there you go.
And the thing about that is, I think that their brains can be so damaged that physically it should be impossible to have any normal consciousness.
Yeah. Well, that's true. They're one of the phenomena that they study through that unit at the University of Virginia is, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's when people have water or fluid on the brain, you know, and they're really about 90% of their brain is incapacitated by that fluid. What's it called?
Is it hydrocephalus?
Yes, that's exactly right. And yet they can be normal or even above normal in as far as intelligence goes. So they're able to operate on very little brain tissue, because it's not the brain that creates the consciousness. It's the brain that integrates it with the body. And so, yeah, that's what they say. And
is there anything in the science that you've looked at that would, I don't know, describe how the physical brain interacts with consciousness? Like the brain is a receiver of consciousness and a...
Well, that's certainly what the University of Virginia, that Division of Perceptual Studies, that's the conclusion they've come to, that certainly the brain affects your consciousness. You know, if you have too much to drink or you take a hallucinogenic drug, it's going to change your consciousness, because the brain is interpreting or receiving the consciousness. It's just like if you had a TV set or a radio, and there was something wrong with it, it would change, you know, you'd get static, or you'd have a fuzzy picture or whatever, based on the fact that the hardware, the TV set or the radio, has got something going on wrong with it. So it's the same thing with the brain, the same idea. How it does it, it seems that consciousness is really non-local. We're like a wavelength. There's really, basically what I think, and I think there are a lot of people who agree with me, there's really only one mind. And we are, I liken ourselves to like a little whirlpool of consciousness within that one mind. One of the metaphors I use, or an allegory that I use, is that it's like the source is dreaming and we are characters within that dream. So we're not really separate from each other or from the whole. We're part of it. But we have this belief, most of us, that we are separate because we have memories of our childhood. We have a subconscious mind that has all kinds of things stored in it, beliefs and so forth. And so it makes us think we're separate, but we're really one part of it. It all blends together. It's everywhere. One of the things that quantum physicists talk about are, you know, the spooky action at a distance, how two molecules can talk to each other over infinite distances and it happens infinitely. Well, it happens infinitely because it's all one mind. And so there is no distance in that one mind. And so we, as conscious beings, are really conscious, are really everywhere at once. That's why you often hear about someone who has a relative or a child or a loved one who has an accident or gets killed or something, maybe halfway around the world, and yet you get some sort of a premonition or a feeling about it instantly. It doesn't take time for that to travel here. It's because we're all part of this one mind. And the brain, well, as we've been saying, is like a radio receiver that picks that up. It doesn't produce it. It does affect it. If you get bumped on the head, you know, that's going to cause your consciousness maybe to go out for a while until you come back. So there you go. That's the way I see it.
It's interesting that quantum physics might be saying that this, maybe this consciousness is everywhere and we're all a part of it, which is what religion has been saying for a couple of thousand years, that God is everywhere.
Well, yeah, you know, that's what you bring up there is very interesting, because that's certainly what the Hindus believe. The ancient Rishis came to that conclusion 5,000 years ago, that there's really only one consciousness. The Vedas talk about that, they're holy books, and that we all come from that. The Buddhists, I guess, have the same idea, and so do the Shintos and other Eastern religions. The thing about Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and I believe that Jesus was an enlightened being, and he really knew what he was talking about, but he was a little bit misunderstood, because the Jews believed that God was an anthropomorphic, a human-like being who created everything, Yahweh. And the Gentiles that also became Christians, well, they had a whole pantheon full of gods, like Zeus and Mercury and Venus and so on and so forth, a whole bunch of them. And they were all human-like figures that lived up on Mount Olympus or wherever it was they lived. But so that idea of an external God, I think, kind of makes the Western religions a little different. Although we have now come around to, I think, understanding that, I guess what in the Christian church is called the Holy Spirit is everywhere and is in as and is within everyone. But it's not quite as clear as the Hindus put it when they talk about Brahma, which is the force or the consciousness that creates everything and that we're all.
Well, I wanted to move on and talk about J.B. Rhine's ESP experiments.
Oh, yeah. J.B. Rhine was a psychology professor at Duke University, which is in North Carolina, not too far from where I am right now. And he set up a laboratory. He was he was really interested in life after death, but the way he approached it was just to try to figure out whether ESP, extrasensory perception, was possible. And so he did a lot of experiments in the 30s. I think he started in the 1930s and it went all the way up until the 1960s, where he would have his students come in and there would be a student who looked at mainly at a little flash card that either had a star on it or some other kind of figure. And then somebody else would say what that other person was looking at and try to send them the signal. And over the course of time, it became very clear that ESP is real, that almost always they would get results that were higher or more accuracy than could have been done by chance. You know, statistically significant results. And in fact, he had some students who were so good at it that they never missed. I mean, they could go through a whole bunch of these cards and get every one of them right. But I've been down to the Ryan Institute in North Carolina because, as I said, it's not that far from me. And it's still there. It's no longer part of the university, however, because I think the scientific materialists, you know, shooed them out of there because they didn't want somebody messing with their theories that all that exists is material substance and that the brain is what creates consciousness. But they're still there and they're still doing their experiments.
And there was a guy there called Hubert Pierce? He was really good, was he?
You know, the other thing was that they did experiments, and I guess this guy was one of the ones who got so many of them right, but they also tested whether psychokinetics were possible, whether you could actually roll dice and affect the outcome. And they got statistically significant results on that with some people. Some people apparently are able to do that to a certain extent, affect the outcome of some physical thing, whether it's rolling the dice or bending a spoon or whatever, that psychokinetics is a possibility. And in fact, one of the things that theories that people have about the pyramids and about all these structures that are made out of tremendously heavy stones, 70-ton stones that are up, in the case of the pyramid, up over 300 feet high. How in the world did they lift them up there? They think it might have been back in those, at that time, in that place where psychokinetics had been developed to an extent where people could actually move those things with their minds. Who knows? I mean, that it's an interesting idea. I don't know whether it's true, but I don't think they could have lifted them up there. And they certainly didn't have the equipment to do that.
And so within ESP, there's remote viewing.
I interviewed a gentleman, Skip Atwater is his name, who was actually the head of, I interviewed him a couple of times. He actually headed up a unit of the United States Army that had been put together to spy on the Eastern Bloc countries and the Soviet Union using remote viewing. And basically what that is someone who they would have people who they recruited out of the Army who had these, didn't know it perhaps, but they'd give them tests and find out they had some psychic abilities. And they would then train them. They could actually somehow in their mind see what was going on in some distant place. For example, in the end of the 1980s, when Iran was overthrown by the mullahs and the hostages were taken at the U.S. Embassy, they were able to use that psychic viewing to go in and see what was going on with the uh, with the people in the embassy and where they were, and they planned to rescue them, but the whole thing got foiled by a sandstorm that came up and caused the helicopter that they were going to use to crash. But that technique was used successfully for years. And finally, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed. But and after that, they disbanded it. But I think they really disbanded it, if they disbanded it, it still may be going on secretly. But if they disbanded it, it was because, again, the scientific materialists didn't like it. But they also used it, and I think I've mentioned this in the book or talk about it, write about it, that it was used to determine when Skylab, which was a multi-ton satellite that the astronauts used, was winding down and was going to crash. They had three different psychics determine where it was going to land, where it was going to crash. And three psychics independently, who were known for being able to do this kind of remote viewing, because, again, it doesn't matter. It's time doesn't exist in the mind that we all share. So the future, they could look into the future as well as into the past. But they all came within 5 yards and 5 miles of the same landing place for that Skylab. And it was in some distant remote place in Australia where it came down, thank goodness. Because if it had come down on New York or London, we'd be in big trouble. But, the remote viewing is a real thing. It happens. And there are people who do it now. One guy I interviewed uses it to find archaeological stuff, you know, where ancient city might be buried, or where, I guess, treasure could be. And he goes off and, you know, finds the stuff because he's figured out where it is using his psychic ability, his remote viewing ability.
So if we could move on, this is great talking about these different stuff. I love this stuff. Julie Byshaw's research, I invited her on the podcast, but she declined. And I really wanted to talk to her about how she works and what she does with mediums. Could you give us an overview of what she does?
Talked with her a couple of times. Julie has a PhD in pharmaceuticals. And she, at the University of Arizona, I believe is where she got it. And of course, someone who works with pharmaceuticals has to use double-blind testing to see if the pharmaceuticals work or not. Typically, what they do is they give a new pharmaceutical to one group of people who has whatever problem the drug is supposed to solve. They give them the real stuff, and they give another group of individuals who has the problem a sugar pill or a placebo. And so that's called a double-blind kind of test where they can see if the real stuff works or not. And so that is how she was trained. And then Julie's mother committed suicide, which is a horrible thing to, if you can imagine your mother or father committing suicide, or your sister, or your brother, terrible thing. And this, of course, upset her, and she was not a religious person or hadn't really been brought up that way. And so, but she started wondering, you know, does her mother still exist? What is the deal with her mother? So she started working with a guy at the University of Arizona, where she was at that time, who was studying this sort of thing, psychic phenomena, and working with psychics. And eventually, Julie went on her own, and her husband was also interested in the paranormal, and they started what's called the Winbridge Institute, which I believe you can go online and find that. They have a website now. And what she did was test people who claimed to be psychics using these double-blind experiments, the double-blind, setting it up so that there's no way that the person who claims to be psychic can be getting this information another way than through psychic phenomena. And she has a whole protocol that she uses to test people. And I believe she actually lists the people on her website who pass this test, so that if you have a relative you want to communicate with who's gone on, you can get in touch with one of them. But that's what she did. And I asked her, I said, well, did you ever talk with your mom through a psychic? And she said, no, my mom came to me in a dream and we had a conversation that way. So, but anyway, Julie, a very scientifically minded person, and uses all the protocol to make sure it's for real, has demonstrated that some psychics are able to do what they claim to be able to do, which is to communicate with people who are on, quote, on the other side, end quote. So there you go.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? Because people will say psychic mediums will look at you and how your face responds, and they kind of read you and they do fishing and trying to find things out. But with her testing, they can't do that.
Exactly. And the way that she was able to keep that from happening was she would have an intermediary where the person who wanted to communicate with their deceased loved one would know that this was the time that it was happening, because apparently that's important for the deceased loved one to show up, to know that somebody wants to communicate with them that they love, you know, that's a loved one. But they would have the person who is communicating with the psychic, typically over the telephone, not be that person, you see, so that the person who was communicating with the psychic didn't know whether it was the right answer or the wrong answer, and couldn't give any clues. Do you see what I mean? So that's how she made it double blind, and so that the psychic couldn't get feedback or clues from the person that she was talking to. But the person who wanted to know about the deceased person was aware of that this was going on, but not listening to it at the time. Later on, they would get a recording or something. So there you go. That's how that worked, if I recall correctly. Yeah, but she had it all set up that way so that there was no cheating, way to cheat.
So I've made a note of something I read about in your book, the case of the Icelandic drunkard.
Yeah, this was one of the gentlemen that I interviewed who had been studying all this psychic phenomena stuff. He's the guy who wrote the Gold Leaf Lady book, which we could talk about if you like. But essentially, he had researched all these strange psychic paranormal events that had happened. And one of them was the Icelandic drunkard. What happened there was this group that would get together and Iceland, and would have like a seance. And this spirit came through who had lost his leg or something like that, and he wanted to get his leg back. And he explained to the group where the leg was, and they went out and they actually found it. I mean, this... So anyway, I've forgotten the details of that story, but yeah, I mean, and he had some great stories like that, where, you know, these things that are impossible if all that exists is material substance, and there isn't any such thing as a common mind that we all share, can't possibly be real, but they happen. And this was one demonstration. I think they found this guy's leg maybe bare in a wall or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was wherever he said it was, yeah, hidden in this wall. It was there. They got it out. I guess they probably buried it wherever he was so he could be back together again.
What if death isn't the end, but a doorway? In my book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, people share what they saw while clinically dead, details later verified by others. These aren't dreams or visions. They're real accounts backed by facts that no one could have known. Quiet, powerful, and deeply moving, this book invites you to rethink what life and death really mean. Verified Near-Death Experiences, available now wherever books are sold. It must have been a troubled spirit trying to get his body back together.
Yeah, exactly.
There's something else weird happening that you write about with transplant cases and the people inherit the characteristics of the donor.
Well, there are several cases. I'm not sure which ones I put in that book, but one had to do with a gentleman who had a heart and lung transplant. And let's see, how did that work? Oh, it was a woman who had a heart and lung transplant. And she was a little lady who never drank. But after she had the transplant, she had these cravings for beer and something else.
Is it chicken nuggets?
Chicken nuggets and beer, yeah. Chicken nuggets and beer. KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken Nuggets. Anyway, she couldn't figure it out. Well, in a dream, this guy who had had a motorcycle wreck and crashed his motorcycle and was killed, and it was his heart and lungs that would donate to the lady. He came to her in a dream and said, "I gave you my heart." And so she did some investigating. She found out that this guy that she got the heart and lung from was her donor, and that he had been killed on a motorcycle. And inside his motorcycle jacket, the day that when he was killed, the accident when he was killed, was a box of chicken nuggets and a six pack of beer. So she figured it out. Another one was this guy, I think he was in some European country like Romania, or doesn't really matter. But he after getting, I think it was maybe a kidney transplant or something like that, wasn't a heart, but he started having these desires he was a tough guy who, like a construction worker type guy who, you know, liked beer and all that kind of stuff. And he started liking cleaning things, sweeping out the house and mopping the floors. And then he had actually sued the doctor of the hospital because they gave him the kidney or whatever he got from a little old lady who'd been a cleaning woman. And that's where he got his desire to do the cleaning. So, that sort of thing apparently happens.
And it's weird to wonder what's going on there. It's like we might say, or the theory would be, that the brain stores all the memories. That's where all the emotions are. But it seems as though our organs are storing something as well, something that can be transferred.
Yeah, apparently that's true. People, you know, even now, nobody knows where the memories are. And these sort of things would indicate that they're really everywhere, and the whole body is permeated. There are some that think really the emotions are more in the heart. The idea of, you know, have a heart is a kind of cliche old expression, but it's true. That's where a lot of the emotions are stored. And so, yeah, they're not just in the brain. They're definitely all over.
So, yeah, moving on to another one. This is one that I'm really fascinated in. Children's past life memories. And there really seems to be something going on there, doesn't there? This just seems to be all around us. Like when my daughter was about 4 years old, we were in the kitchen. She said to me, "You know, I used to pick you up when you were this small." And that's the only thing she ever said. But, you know, it could be happening all around us.
Well, there are some just absolutely amazing stories. I guess the one that I tell in that book, Afterlife, the Whole Truth, is about the boy who basically said he was a fighter pilot in World War II. This would have been 20-some years ago, where he was shot down at the Battle of Iwo Jima, which took place in April 1945. His mother and father, from Louisiana, were Southern Baptists, and Southern Baptists do not believe in reincarnation. Most Christians don't. So they didn't really, they just dismissed what he said. But he would have these nightmares where he would be screaming when he was a little over 2 years old, just when he was learning to talk, would be screaming about plane on fire, little man can't get out. And they would ask him what was going on. And apparently he was dreaming that he was in an airplane that was on fire and crashing. And so his mother, I guess, was more receptive to the idea that he might be remembering a past life. But she took him, not on purpose, but she happened to be in a museum that had an airplane. Oh, no, it was a toy store that had an model airplane. And the little boy looked at the model airplane, and the mother was looking at it, and she said, "Oh, look, it has bombs under the wings." And the little boy said, no, Mom, they're not bombs. They're drop tanks." And she said, "Drop tanks? What are drop tanks?" He said, "Drop tanks are gas tanks that allow the plane to fly a longer distance, and when they run out of gas, they just release them and they drop." Well, that was right. Anyway, as the boy got a little older, he would tell these stories. And his father asked him, he said, "Well, that he had flown off a ship, off a boat." He said, "I flew from a boat." He said, "What was the name of the boat?" And the little boy said, "Well, it was the Nakoma. And so the father found a book that had United States Navy ships, in it, pictures of them and information about them. And he looked up, and sure enough, there was an aircraft carrier that was active in World War II. It was called the Nakoma Bay. Well, the boy told even more stories and about how he was shot down at Iwo Jima, and how these other guys were there that, he gave their names and so forth. Finally, the father took the boy to a reunion of the sailors and airmen who had been on that ship, that Nakoma Bay, and he recognized them. And he said, "They're so old." He was probably about the year 2000 or so when that took place. So finally, the boy was introduced to his sister, who had been his sister in the previous life that he knew all about. So anyway, there's no doubt that this kid was the reincarnation of, I think his name was John Houston, and his birth name was John, also John, but John Lininger or something like that. And there are other stories like that. I interviewed a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia who did these studies. His name is Jim B. Tucker, and he's an MD. And he's written two different books that are full of these kind of stories of children who remember past lives. And so he had a bunch of stories. But yeah, it apparently happens. And one of the things that's interesting about it to me is that typically the children that they've studied over 2,500 cases, because they started this back in the 1960s with Ian Stevenson was the first guy who started this at the University of Virginia. And he wrote a book that came out in the late 60s called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And after that, he wrote even more books about it. But the interesting thing is that they've got so many of these cases, 1,700 of them or so have been what they call solved, which means they found the person the child was referring to, by where they lived, what their occupation was, who their relatives were, what their name was, that kind of stuff. They've got over 1,700 that were solved. So there are enough of them that they can look at them statistically. And the average distance between the death and the rebirth is only 15 months. And a lot of these kids were their previous life was ended in an abnormal way. Either they were murdered, they were killed in a war, they were in a traffic accident, something that cut their life short. So it seems like maybe you can speculate that they decided to come back fairly quickly, because 15 months, well, 9 months for pregnancy. So they came back right away. Now, I'm a Rosicrucian adept. After I had a out-of-body experience, I got interested in metaphysics and started studying it, and I joined the Rosicrucian Society, which is a society that studies metaphysics, mystics. And their belief is that the average time between birth is 140 years. So if you live 70 years, you're going to have 70 years on Earth and 70 years in the non-physical realm, what Christians would call heaven or hell. And, you know, you come back. So the idea that you come back in that short a time would indicate that, you know, somebody felt shortchanged, their life was cut short, so they come back right away. So that's kind of what conclusion I came to. And another interesting thing about, here I am giving a long-winded answer, is how many of them have birth defects or some indication of the wound that killed them. For example, there was one man who was a school teacher in India, and he was on his way to school when he was shot in the forehead. Somebody shot him in the forehead. And of course, the wound, there was an entrance wound and an exit wound. And the child had a spot on his forehead and a birthmark on the back of his head that was a splat like the exit wound. There are others there was one child who was born with part of his leg missing, who had died because he was run over by a train and had severed his leg. So things like that. It's amazing.
And I think you've got somebody in your book where it's the child who is his own grandfather.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's like your daughter. You mentioned the particular, this dad was changing his son's diaper. Like maybe 18 months, just starting to talk. And he looked up at his dad and said, you know, when I was your age, I used to change your diaper, something like that. And anyway, so the child was the father of his father. And when his mother died, he went to clean out her house and so forth and found some old photographs and an school album and so forth and brought them back. And he put this picture of a class of kids, you know, 8 or 9 years old on the coffee table, put the picture out. And the child, went and picked himself out of that picture of, you know, 20 kids. That's me, he said. And he was right.
You were talking just now about this thing with birth defects and birthmarks coming through from past lives, so it seems. But have you got any idea what the process might be? Is it something the soul is imprinting something on the fetus?
Well, you know, according to people who are into all of this, there is an etheric kind of body that is under, in the case of you and me right now, that gives us our shape, and that continues. And so I think if these kids are not going through whatever it is you go through when you're in the afterlife, they're kind of hanging around and then coming back really quickly, their etheric body is got that damage mark still on it. And when they come into the mother's womb and take over that body, that defect is still there. I believe, though, that normally you would go into the afterlife, into another realm, and things would all get shaken out. And you don't come back in 15 months or, you know, less. So normally I would say that doesn't happen. But in the case of these kids that their life is cut short and they decide to come back really quickly, their etheric body still has that damage place on it, and it shows up in the fetus.
Yes, it's almost like a glitch in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I wanted to move on to something else, which is the phenomenon of stuck souls, which I find fascinating. I was talking to a guy who does out-of-body experiences, and he was taught at the Monroe Institute. And he said that he came across a woman in a kitchen who was stirring a pot of dinner. And she was worried because her husband hadn't come back. And he realized this woman had been doing this for maybe 50 years. And she was stuck in the kitchen and she died 50 years ago. So he helped her on. But it seemed like for her, it was only like a couple of hours had passed, not 50 years.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about non-physical realm. There is no, the time doesn't exist there the way it does with us. We live in a four-dimensional reality here in this reality that you and I are in right now. We have height, depth, width, and time, four dimensions. That dimension of time does not exist in the afterlife dimension or the pre-life dimension. It's all one time there. So, I'll give you, I've got an example that is similar to what you just talked about, the lady. There are a couple of them, actually. One is my first wife was French, and I spent quite a lot of time on vacations over 15 years that we were married in France. We actually bought a house over there. And she would go there in the summer, and I would come for two or three weeks. And we had some good friends, and one of her best friends was married to a count who is from Lorraine. His name is Dimitri. And he inherited, along with his title, inherited a, well, they call it a castle, but it's a big house. What I guess England would be like a manor house. And we would sometimes go to visit them. And once we went to visit them up in Lorraine, and Henri, the count, knew that I was interested in this sort of thing. And he told me a story. He said that when he inherited this house, which had not been lived in for probably since before, this was in the 1980s, mid-1980s, he said it probably had not been lived in since before World War II, and it was in disrepair, and he made some money in the stock market and done well and decided to fix it up. So he and his wife would go up there on the weekend. He lived in Paris. He would go up there on the weekends and would supervise the work and, you know, talk about, well, it's this kind of wallpaper and what are we going to do about the roof and so on and so forth. But they would sleep in the house, and at night when just as he was like falling asleep, both he and his wife would feel like they heard somebody calling for help. And, you know, and then he'd wake up and it would stop. And, you know, so in the middle of the night, he'd wake up and he'd hear someone calling for help. Well, this went on and on. And finally, he went looking for, you know, where it might be coming from. And he went down into the lower level, into what would be, I guess, the wine cellar. And he noticed that there was a wall down there that looked a little different, looked a little newer than the rest of the cellar. So the workmen were there doing their work that day. And he got a couple of them to come down there and tear down that wall. And well, what was behind the wall? A skeleton was behind the wall. And so they took the skeleton out and they gave it a Christian burial, and they never heard the night noises after that. But his theory was that this guy had been bopped on the head or whatever, taken down to the cellar, bricked up behind the wall, but he came to. And he'd been trying to get out and calling for help ever since, which would have been 50 years or so. So there you go.
Yeah, it's weird, this concept, this perception of how time passes in different ways, because we hear from people who have near-death experiences that they might have been receiving CPR and their brain's flatlined for 2 minutes, and they come back and say, well, my near-death experience seemed to last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, it's the idea that there is no at least time is not the same. Another story that I heard, this was by also someone from who had this experience at the Monroe Institute. The Monroe Institute, by the way, is only about 50 or 60 miles away from me here in Virginia, up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And so I know other people who've gone there and, you know, taken part. And this particular guy, a good friend of mine, lawyer, is very much into all this sort of thing and has been to the Monroe Institute a number of times. And they apparently go out on out-of-body kind of, what would you call it, reconnaissance, and look for people who are stuck to try to help, you know, people who've died, who don't realize they're dead, and get them to look for the light and go on to the light. This guy came upon a sailor who was clinging to a piece of wreckage in the Irish Sea, which is probably very close to you, somewhere between, what, Wales and Ireland.
Yeah.
Had been clinging to this piece of wreckage, ship wreckage, for over 100 years. And didn't know he was dead. And my friend, you know, chatted with him and got him to realize it and got him to see the light and go on. So, yeah, I mean, apparently there are stuck souls who are either killed very quickly or and they don't know they're dead. There was a, I don't know if you have it in the UK, but there was a show back in the 50s and 60s called The Twilight Zone. And I remember an episode in The Twilight Zone where this woman has a automobile accident, and then she, you know, goes on, and when you get to the end of the show, she's done all this stuff, but she didn't realize she was dead. Well, somebody knew about that phenomenon back then, because that was the basic plot of that show. But so, yeah, it happens. People are killed quickly. It could happen in battle, you know, or... And they transition, and they don't know they're dead. And they don't have time like we have it here. So they just kind of get into a loop where they're doing the same thing over and over, like the lady you talked about in the kitchen who's stirring the pot.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called Afterlife, The Whole Truth, Second Edition, Powerful Evidence You Will Never Die. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That'd be the place to go. They're going to have the best price on it.
Can you quickly tell us about your other books? And do you have a website?
I do. You can go to my website and see my other books there. It's S.H. Martin, S-H-M-A-R-T-I-N.com. I would say the other book that people probably be interested in is called Fast Track to Higher Consciousness. And it gets into the science behind the true nature of reality being one mind that we're all part of, that we're all characters in the dream that the source is having. And Fast Track to Higher Consciousness. But there are others there that you might find interesting. So just go into my website, click on the, up at the top, there'll be fiction and nonfiction books. Click on that and you'll see them.
Well, great. And thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure, Simon. Thanks for having me.
This week, I was talking to Stephen Hawley Martin about his book, Afterlife, The Whole Truth, second edition. Powerful evidence you will never die. If you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.